in flames at the moment of impact. The first tower, of course, there on the right, already burning. Life in America has changed forever as a result of these events and the hijacked plane that smashed into the Pentagon. And that's what Time magazine is looking like as it comes out.
It's interesting, too, John, that is the first cover with a black border they've had since 1927. So again, as if it need any reminder how tragic all these events were.
Well, if you thought that they had everything under control, at least fire-wise, in lower Manhattan, that is not the case at all. You can see that that cloud of smoke continues to burn, and who knows what else is in there. You know, there was about 4 inches of concrete on each and every floor of the World Trade Center. You times that by 110 for each tower, you've got something like, 20 feet perhaps or more of concrete per building. In fact, I think my math is wrong there. I think I'm way low. I should do it again, but feet and feet of concrete that would cover a city block in any good-sized American city has just been reduced to powder. And that is a part of what's flying up in the air right now.
And you know, it's interesting, John, having been there many, many times myself, beneath the World Trade Center complex is a vast underneath labyrinth of tunnels. There's a shopping mall down there. So there's quite a bit of room, pockets, if you will, and even Rudolph Giuliani had said as much, where if you're looking for survivors, that's the possibility they cling to, that in that area, if that did not fall, and in some areas we're told that structurally that is still sound, you could, in fact, find survivors. In fact, that has been sort of like the last gasp of hope for these guys, since they knew of this mall, and it's a vast network underneath there. I can tell you myself, it connects virtually much of the lower east side there, that it's distinctly possible they could find victims, or at least that's where they're hoping to find those who might have survived this. That's what it comes to, but as you indicated, it's all that stuff on top that makes it dicey.
Well, it is an awful situation, and it still continues. They are still hoping to be able to pull survivors out of that rubble down there. Edie Donahue has a bird's eye view of this thing from the roof of our building. Edie, what are you seeing from up there?
Well, John, as you know, we've been watching the smoke as it rises above the area where they've been working. And definitely over the last 10 or so minutes, there has been a huge increase in the amount of smoke. At first, it was very black. Now it seems much whiter than it was before. But, you know, they're battling a number of things. There is an incredible wind, not only here where we are, but when you get down there to the Wall Street area, it just whips through the concrete canyons down there, and that could be flaring up the embers down on those buildings. We also know that the Millennium Hotel and several other buildings were having a difficulty this morning. And so the rescue workers down there have an incredibly immense job on their hands, that being made much more difficult simply because of the elements here. They've also cut electricity down to that area because they were concerned that electrical sparks during the rescue effort could start new fires. They have been using generators through the night. Now, that sounds fine, except for the fact that the generators then interfere with their electronic listening devices. So it seems that whatever they try to do to take safety precautions, they have to sacrifice somewhere else. Of course, the rescue and recovery continues tragically. They found one man's body, his cell phone still clutched in his hand, and they removed him. Another body brought out with the American flag wrapped around it, and they believe they may have found what could be one of the hijackers, because they found a hand, or a leg that is, and a foot near a cockpit seat. Eric Shawn has been covering all of this for us live from Ground Zero. He is seeing some of the worst of it. Eric, good morning.
Good morning, Edie. We also understand that some portions of the plane have been recovered in that area, that they are visible of one of the two planes, at least, or perhaps both, in the middle of that pit. I also now want to introduce you to a man who is the heart and soul of the rescue team here. What he will tell you in the story you're going to hear right now can be told by many people here. He really captures the spirit of this, what's going on. He is a New York City firefighter, John Morabito. He is a member of the first unit, Ladder Company 10, that arrived at the scene. He lost many of his firefighter brothers. He was there when one of the buildings went down. We talked to him here just about 10 minutes ago, and here is what he told us.
And with regard to There were bodies lying in the street, bodies still moving, people completely burned. I would imagine it was from the jet fuel that fell from the building. We got into the lobby, we started evacuating. They gave a report about 18 minutes later, prepare for impact, the second plane is approaching, prepare for impact.
That's what you heard on the radio?
I heard that on my fire department radio. We felt the impact of the second plane, the building shook, the lights flickered, people started to panic, we rushed 3,000-4,000 people out down through the subways. Me personally, I was there, I witnessed these people escaping the building. Moments later, the lights went out and number two collapsed into number one. I managed to climb over some rubble and get myself out a window along with other firefighters and a couple of civilians, and then we ran toward the water. It was absolute hell, and just hoping and praying to God, he put a shell around me, he protected me. I braced myself for the worst possible impact. I got up, I checked my limbs to see if I was okay, to see if I could move, and I helped a couple of firefighter brothers out of the building, a couple of civilians.
What's your message to the terrorists who did this?
My message is right here. We're going to rebuild this city. We're going to combine nation. We're going to combine our race and creed. And everybody in this country needs to pull together. We have to stand for ourselves. We have to fight. We have to rebuild. We have to remember this day and remember that this can happen at any time. We have to be prepared.
Firefighter Morabito says that he and everyone who's in there desperately working to try and find survivors, they are aware and know about the nation's prayers and thoughts, that they feel that the nation's prayers are with them, and they want to take this opportunity to thank this country and the world for those who are supporting them in their effort here. He said he's not a hero, that he's just doing his job, a job very difficult, obviously, and sadly, one that has not progressed beyond yesterday's recovery of three firefighters, among them, so far, sadly, today, no new victims have been found alive, but we have heard some reports that a firefighter may be in contact via the radio with some of the fellow firefighters. That is not confirmed. We're hearing those type of stories throughout the day, nothing confirmed. But so far, sadly, the numbers tell it all. More than 3,700 people missing, only five recovered. Back to you up in the studio.
Eric, actually, Edie, I'm up here in Midtown Manhattan, and I've got to tell you, you're down there at Ground Zero. We have just been hearing a number of fire sirens racing down towards the Wall Street area, and so there may be a flare-up of another fire there. It is a tough job, and you've certainly been doing a great job covering it. 5 square miles down there, shut down for the rescue efforts. All non-essential personnel kept away. Let's take you back down.
Can I show you the...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I just want to show you the plume from ground level. Look at this plume. It's going up,
we see that here, too.
Huge. And now it's white, as you said before. Depending upon the winds, it sometimes either moves up through us or down south. And it was really dark and gray about 15 minutes ago. So obviously something really started burning, whether it was another building or one of the buildings, or just probably the smoldering concrete and ruins of the buildings that have already collapsed. There were fears earlier today that two other buildings could collapse, one Liberty Plaza and also the Millennium Hotel, but I don't think it's the hotel because that's on this side of the street. So it's just perhaps just a continuation of all that concrete and ruins and dust that's still been burning and the firefighters have been fighting and not been able to completely smother.
You know, Eric, as adults, we're able to, in some way, keep our emotions in check and realize that these things happen and we try to cope with them. You've been down there almost from the start. You've been talking to these rescue workers. I know you spoke with one man earlier today who was holding a scorched doll that clearly had most likely come from one of the child care centers in the World Trade Center, and you realized that these innocent little children were victims as well. How are the rescue workers you're dealing with handling all this emotionally?
Well, it's very difficult for them. I think they try to keep focused on the job. When you're in there, it's very focused, as much as a surgeon or a doctor or other people have to deal with tragedies. Going in, they know they have a mission. They know they want to accomplish that. They are geared up and pumped up to try and find people. And then when they come back here, they walk a couple of blocks, to where we are, and you can just see it on their faces. Earlier today, there were a couple of guys over on the left of me with their faces in their hands, just sacked out. It is exhausting. It is difficult, clearly. Tremendous amount of strain and stress. But what keeps them going is, as firefighter Morabito told us, are the thoughts of the nation, the fact that they hope they can find somebody. But clearly, there will have to be issues of trauma, psychological issues with a lot of people when they see body parts, when they see pieces, when they see all the horrible remnants of this dastardly and despicable terrorist act.
One of the problems they also are facing, just dealing with getting the sheer supplies into them and the numbers that they need. What are you seeing? Are they in need of anything, in need of proper masks to protect them from the asbestos and everything else in the air, in need of food, water?
We have, this is one of the most sophisticated type of masks that you can use that protects you from the asbestos that could be in the air. We were told that the level is four times higher than the acceptable rate over there in the center. But you know what? Most of the masks are much thinner, small ones that you go get at the drugstore that are made, that are not made for toxic material. So a lot of these guys know that, and they're in there anyway, just using the masks to try and breathe as well as they can, as opposed to this more sophisticated type. Some of the units have already prepared and have these type of masks already, and they've been able to take them in. Other guys are in with masks. Some others don't even have any masks at all. But you know what? That is just part of their mission and their zeal to go in, protected or unprotected, to try and lend a hand and get something done, try to save lives, even if their own lives could be theoretically in danger.
All right. Thank you very much, Eric Shawn, reporting live from Ground Zero. Perhaps that's one way that another company, if they're involved in that type of manufacturing, can help out through donations. I know that several large corporations, GE, Cisco, pledging millions of dollars, so that a need as well. Catherine Herridge has been at St. Vincent's Hospital now for the past 2 days, and she has been talking to the desperate family members searching for loved ones that are missing. Catherine?
Edie, with more than 4,700 people missing, the request here from St. Vincent's is don't come to this hospital if you can't locate somebody. You should go to the Patient Services Center, which is located on the east side of the city in one of the armories. There they have comprehensive lists of the injured. They also have some mental health professionals. And if they can't offer the information that you're desperate to get...
Does the rights accorded to patients under this section apply to patients receiving services in outpatient and day service treatment? Does that cover you? It's on page 1446.
Language.
I'm sorry, counsel, you have to stand in front of the microphone so you are recorded as well as amplified.
Thank you. I believe the phrase as well as community mental health programs was added with the amendment in 97.
Does that cover you or not? The case was before 97.
The case was not before 97. Some of the care was before 97.
Well, should I look up the statute when I get off the bench and find out the effective date of the amendment and then determine whether it covers you? I mean, does the first... What is it? I'm sorry. Does SJAJ... First things first, outpatient and day service treatment facility or community health mental health program?
Yes, it must be one of those to get the license from the state,
okay.
As I understand it.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Which one is it? You know?
I believe it's the community mental health program. The terminology there primarily, as I understand it, has a lot to do with the funding and whether the clinic would be available, would be able to get federal and state funding through the Medicaid and those acts, and this clinic was able to do that.
One of the problems I have in looking at 5161, and you've gone through that, and I look at 1A, and it says upon admission or commitment. That sounds like more institutionalized or court-ordered, okay? Then I look under B, and it talks about the right to refuse to perform labor. I look under BA, that deals with the issue of doing labor, as in a labor camp or whatever. Then sub B, the labor is supervised. Sub C talks about labor. Sub D is labor. Then we get to sub 2, speaks about therapeutic labor. I know a little bit about that. Not much. Then A, compensated labor. B, labor does not cause layoffs in the institution. Then C, such labor, again, labor. Then you get to sub 3, performing additional labor. Then another right they have is C, sending sealed mail and receiving sealed mail and being able to write letters. And D, if you're committed for alcoholism, then you have a right to court review. And then E, you have a right to the least restrictive conditions necessary to achieve the purpose of admission. F, you have the right to receive prompt and adequate treatment with regard to and resources from the County Board of Supervisors. Sounds like an institutional or county commitment. FM, the right to be informed of your treatment. And goes on, you have the right to have probable cause under sub 2. I'm just kind of following along. Probable cause for commitment. And then you have following a commitment. In sub 3, you have another right. And then another following commitment. And then the right to refuse medication. The right not to be subjected to experimental research. The right not to be subjected to treatment procedures. And I can go on and on. This is a long thing. But my point is, every one of those many pages, to me, implies something other than my neighborhood mental health care, you know, Wausau Associated Therapist's Office. You know, I mean, so how do you explain that?
I mean, well, I believe that some of the provisions, including, again, X.
X is the only one. Okay. Other than X, tell me which
one. I don't think
one.
X is the only one. FM, I think, applies.
Okay, let me, you may be right, but what does F1, are you saying?
FM.
FM of what?
Have the right to be informed of his or her treatment and care, okay, and to participate in planning.
That to me
GA,
is... Okay, just stop it.
That's on 1445.
J is what? The right to not be subjected to experimental research.
Correct. Or treatment procedure, K, treatment procedures such as psychosurgery, M. M, I'm incorrect about it.
Well, I mean, look at J.
And M.
That's the right not to be subjected to experimental research. At first blush, that sounds like, yeah, that's a real broad one. But then the second sentence of J says, such proposed research shall first be reviewed and approved by the institution's Research and Human Rights Committee. You know, that's the second sentence of J. Again, that speaks to me of an institution.
In addition to the statute itself, we have the administrative rules that Health and Social Services have promulgated to carry this out, which contain a number of provisions that apply to either of those situations, not to be videotaped during therapy, for example. I think a very important one is to preserve the confidentiality of records, which applies whether they're in the hospital or the committed or admitted setting or not. The language of 5161.1 basically breaks into two categories. And the one category is anybody, any individual who is receiving mental health services. Why did the legislature do that? Because these are among our most vulnerable citizens. And then the second are those situations in which a person is committed or admitted, and then there are some exclusions there so that we're not dealing with prisoners or people committed under 975. So it's an umbrella definition. And clearly what the Health and Social Services has interpreted, and I think they're entitled to due deference in this circumstance, is that we want to make sure that those of our citizens who have to receive mental health services receive it at a minimum standard of care.
What is a private hospital? What does that include?
Pardon?
What does a private hospital include?
If it depends on what the hospital is. If it's a hospital that has a mental health ward and a person is admitted for mental health care, then they fall under that portion of the statute. If, however, it's a private hospital that has an emergency room and somebody happens to show up in a disturbed mental state, they are clearly excluded under those circumstances because the hospital isn't there to provide mental health services. It's there to provide general health services.
And all the services in this case were basically outpatient. There was so there was no hospitalization under any, whether it's private, public, whatever.
Correct. And no orders by anyone. It was a voluntary seeking of mental health services from a licensed facility by somebody who was suffering from depression, among other things.
How do you deal with the language from Sherry versus Salvo that was quoted in the Court of Appeals opinion as saying patient is defined as?
I think there the Court of Appeals, first of all, I think it's dicta to the decision, and secondly, I think that the Court of Appeals was parsing the language under those particular circumstances and not looking at the total definition. Wright versus Mercy is another case where we have a therapist, in that case a woman, providing services to a mentally ill patient involved in sexual exploitation, and even though the hospital was found only to be 25% responsible, they were required to pay 100% of the attorney's fees and costs under 5161.
Can a private mental health clinic come under the definition of private hospital? Or are they mutually exclusive?
I believe that they would be exclusive because of the definitions. Although I suppose a private hospital could, the way these outfits are run anymore, gets very confusing. I suppose they could have a portion of their hospital which is called the private hospital mental health clinic. The issue is. Did they seek out the licensing that is required under 5161? And in this case, First Things First did in 1991, and then they had to recertify after that.
Why would some outpatient mental health patients be excluded if they were involved in a hospital? What you would call a hospital, and what we'd all commonly think of as a hospital. But other people are basically doing exactly the same thing, not be covered.
As I read the statute, the only persons in the hospital that would be excluded would be if they were at the hospital in an emergency room setting or on an occasional outpatient basis. Then, because there is no continuing relationship under those circumstances between the facility and the patient, they should not be held to this higher standard. But once the facility, whatever it's named, takes on the duty of providing the staffing and complying with all the regulations that apply to those facilities, Once they've done that, then they have the special duty which arises in this case, and which is non-delegable. And in this case, the clinic took it upon themselves to include in their governing documents, they included these provisions, therefore creating the contractual basis on which non-delegable duty could be found. They took the shorthand of just saying, we incorporate these administrative code provisions. But if they had spelled them out in their documents, it would be the same thing. And as I said before, I think that the non-delegable duty could also be found under common law. It boggles my mind to think that our laws have concluded that man who has his son carry water across the sidewalk to wash his car, and the son spills the water on the sidewalk under cold conditions, knowing that it will create ice, but there's a non-delegable duty there, but there isn't one here when a mentally disturbed patient goes to a state-licensed facility and says, I need help. And the state-licensed facility says, well, we're not responsible for your sexual exploitation by this particular doctor because he's an independent contractor. I don't think that First Things First could argue. They can't because of right. They couldn't argue that they wouldn't be responsible if he was an employee, because we see in right that the employee was responsible. And we're probably going to hear later on about Block and Gomez. They never addressed this issue. They never addressed non-delegable duty. In fact, you folks didn't address it when you looked at the Lewis case not too long ago. Because I understand it, non-delegable duty came up only, that's the captain of the ship case, it came up only in oral argument. This is a case where non-delegable duty has been at the center of the case all throughout the trial. Also, Lewis, it was stipulated that Lewis had absolutely no fault, which is a little bit different than this case where the clinic was found to be negligent in its supervision.
Thank you, Mr. Pellis. Mr. Steens, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Pellis, Attorney Pellis, you represent First Things First, Frontier Insurance Company.
May it please this court, Chief Justice Abramson and counsel, good morning. I am James Pellis. I'm from Rice Lake. I represent First Things First, a counseling clinic from Eau Claire, and its insurer, Frontier. What SJAJ has argued in her briefs and this morning is that her reading of 5161 is the only reasonable interpretation of that statute, that it's plain and unambiguous. However, she conveniently forgets that before this case, the interpretation I have put forward, the reading that I have put forward, and before this case thought was the plain, unambiguous meaning, was the same meaning that was put forth in the Sherry case. That is, that for one to be a patient under Chapter 51, under 5161, you have to be committed, admitted, or detained in a facility actually providing treatment for mental health facilities.
Now, did any of the cases say that, or was that the fact situation in that case, in
no,
each of the cases?
Justice, that was not dicta. That was the Sherry Court's interpretation of what a patient was under 5161 for the Bill of Rights.
You think that was the exclusive definition that covers all cases, not only the case that was involved?
I'm sorry, do I think?
Yeah, you quote Sherry on page 27 of your briefs. Defines patient in two contexts. Persons admitted or committed to or detained at, and two, persons admitted to general hospitals for such treatment. Do they have to be admitted under court order?
That used to be the case before 1975. Now, people can be admitted to mental health facilities operated by the department or a county department as an outpatient. They can also voluntarily undergo inpatient or outpatient treatment in lieu of commitment or involuntary admission or detention.
Under 5161, I'm looking at pages 25 of your brief, where you indicate three doesn't mean what it seems to say. You indicate three means that, if I remember this, that you got to be under an order. Isn't that right?
I don't find it on page 25 of the
brief. No, it's preceding that. I'm sorry. It starts at 20. Your position, as I understand, is the only treatment, inpatient or outpatient, under 51, is treatment compelled by the state, a court, or a state agency.
Yes.
Where do you see that in sub 3?
You won't find it in sub 3, Chief Justice. You have to look at that subsection the totality of the entirety of Chapter 51. And Chapter 51 talks about providing services through the state or the county departments to people in need of mental health treatment. And it does not apply, if you look at 51, sub 1, because the legislative intent that's spelled out is to provide services within the limits of available state and federal funds and of county funds required to be appropriated. The only people on whom the state or the county is expending these funds are those people who are admitted, committed, or detained, or who voluntarily enter treatment. These are the people who are compelled. These are the folks who need the rights. The statutes do say that they apply to outpatients insofar as is appropriate. I went through all 24 of these patients' Bill of Rights, and I found only three that could be realistically applied to outpatients, and they are the ones counsel talked about, the right to treatment, or the right FM, the right to be informed of his or her treatment and care and participate in the planning. But that is within the context of sub F, which says that there's a right to receive prompt and adequate treatment that the county is reasonably able to provide within the limits of available state and federal funds and of county funds required. That's sub F. The only ones that realistically apply to an outpatient would be confidentiality of records, the right not to be filmed or taped, and the right to be treated with respect and recognition of the patient's dignity. And there are, in fact, statutory protections independent of the Bill of Rights for all three of those. 146.82 deals with confidentiality of patient health records. The 146.83 deals with access. 146.84 even provides that it's a violation of the criminal law to violate the confidentiality of healthcare records. 895.50 provides a right of privacy to prevent an abuse or videotaping of people receiving treatment. 895.70.
Your position is that even if it covered your client, the whole Bill of Rights, there's nothing in this Bill of Rights that gave them the right to good care.
No, I don't understand me to be saying that. I'm saying that there is a duty built in to any contract. If they don't provide good care, then they may be guilty of malpractice. But it is the Bill of Rights that we are saying do not apply in this case, because SJAJ was not committed, admitted, or detained. She was an outpatient, a pure voluntary outpatient. The amicus brief almost had it right. And understand that this is an amicus brief by the organization charged with being the advocate for the mental health. But they said the key phrase is receiving services at a private treatment facility. Well, what they missed was receiving services is the same phrase that appears in 51001, which is the state's policy to provide services through the department and county departments, i.e. receiving services under this chapter. But the glaring error in the amicus interpretation was that there was not a complete reading. It says through, that's an important word, receiving services through the department or county department, and then it lists one of three ways, community health boards, the 5142 boards, county rehabilitation boards under, I think it's 51, I don't have the number in front of me, but it's in 51, but it's for rehabilitation, and then private health treatment. So if you are receiving services through the department or the county at a private treatment facility, you are protected by the Bill of Rights, whether that private treatment facility is inpatient or outpatient. But the key to the phrase is that you are receiving services through the county or the department. And the county or the department only provides when there is a commitment, an admission, or a detention.
Counsel, could you just reiterate what section you were reading from just now? What section of the statute?
It's 5161 sub 1. It's the general definition of who a patient is. I actually went to the trouble. It contains what must be a record, even for Chapter 51, for the length of a sentence. But if you look at 5161, it says patient means any individual receiving services for mental illness, then the great word including. SJ says including is expansive. Including, as we know in Wisconsin, is either limiting, restrictive, or including among the whole. The reason I believe it's restrictive here is because it goes on to list the four categories of people in this incredibly long sentence. One is individuals admitted under this chapter, Chapter 48 or Chapter 55. Two, Category 2, anyone who is detained, committed, or placed under this chapter or five other chapters. Three, anyone who is transferred under, and it lists the two provisions, juveniles and criminal commitments, and then it goes to the broad grant, which is four, anyone who is receiving care or treatment for those conditions through the department or a county department under the 5142 board, the 51437 board, and a private treatment facility. But that necessarily involves commitment, admission, or detention at the private treatment facility. Otherwise,
it doesn't say and, it says or, though, doesn't it?
I beg your pardon?
5142 or 51437 or in a private treatment facility.
Yes, and those three are all grouped together under the fourth general heading, anyone who is receiving care or treatment for those conditions through the department or a county department under, and then it ticks them all off without separation. Mm-hmm.
So your position is that Chapter 51 in its entirety applies, and in particular 5161, the Patient's Bill of Rights, applies only to those persons who are receiving services through the public mental health system in some way, even if those are contracted out by whatever public agency is responsible for paying for those services to a private provider, and that somebody like the plaintiff in this case, who is purely a private patient seeking private services completely outside the public mental health system, is not covered.
Exactly. With the caveat, Justice Sykes, that the county or the department in this case being the State Department, only become involved when there is some reluctance on the part of the individual who needs services to obtain those services on his or her own will. That's when the state gets involved. That's when there's the coercion. That's why these folks need a Bill of Rights.
So if the state is involved, the public is involved because they're paying for it, or because there's some compulsion by way of involuntary commitment or court order, then this chapter applies. But if it's a purely private arrangement between a private patient and a private provider, you're outside this chapter.
Precisely.
How do you address, I'm looking at the petitioner's appendix, the discussion around pages of 45 and on. My recollection is this. The court is stating that, look, a contract of services was entered into between SJ and First Things First, that the contract of services incorporated the rights of 5161, the manual for First Things First and administrative rules, that the manual for First Things First specifically states in its preamble, I'm looking at page 45 of the appendix, it quotes, "It is the policy of First Things First to allow no sexual exploitation or harassment of patients or staff by any First Things First personnel." And then paragraph B, the trial court is quoting, "Clinic policies and procedures regarding sexual contact and allegations of sexual contact between staff and patients," subparagraph 1, and I quote again, "absolutely no sexual contact or harassment is permitted between staff, professional and non-professional, and any current or recent client or clients of First Things First." How do you, as I recall, the trial court said there is a non-delegable duty imposed on First Things First through 5161, through administrative code, through contract and common law. Arguably, this is part of the trial court's finding with regard to contract. Not arguably, it is. How do you refute this finding of a non-delegable duty? How do you refute liability for a non-delegable duty under contract, which was found by the trial court?
Well, and I disagreed with the trial court's findings. And the reason I disagreed with the trial court's findings with respect to non-delegable duty arising out of contract was because the contract was, in the first place, unwritten. But in the second place, the contract was a contract to provide counseling services on an outpatient basis. The reason the provisions are in the procedures manual that was read from are several. First and foremost, First Things First desired to treat patients who were sent there under the auspices of the court for alcohol and drug abuse problems, sent there for alcohol and drug abuse assessments under the traffic code. And that's a requirement. Those policies are required by the department. Another reason.
Just a moment.
I may, because everything you say is going to be clouded. I'm still going to be thinking of your first sentence. I understood you to say in your first sentence, first of all, the contract is unwritten.
The contract is...
not written.
That's what I understood you to say.
Yeah, there is no actual contract that exists that says, first things first, we'll provide counseling services to SJAJ. Just as if I were to go to a doctor and say, my arm hurts, the doctor undertakes to treat my arm without a signed contract. And that was what was ongoing here.
There was no contract that says I agree that I will pay the bills of first things first as billed, and I'll make monthly payments and nothing regarding insurance payments or that kind of stuff. There's nothing.
Actually, if memory serves me correctly, Justice Walsh Bradley, there was an insurance form that was tendered, but I don't think it was ever signed. I don't think it was ever returned. That would be the closest to a contract.
An oral contract? Can't you have an oral contract?
You certainly can, Chief Justice.
And there are implied contracts in the law. And we agree that the contract was, I'm going to pay you for the reasonable amounts for the services rendered, and you want to render services to me for my ailment, and your rendering of services is to be at the standard of good care in the community. Let's just say that. Do you think that was the oral contract here?
I agree that that's absolutely what it was.
What was the August 30th, 1993 agreement that the court refers to? The contract between First Things First, I'm reading from page 45 in the appendix. The contract between First Things First and Hatch in this case is not just a document dated August 30th, 1993, which by its terms incorporates the, strike that, by its terms, the August 30th, 1993 agreement incorporates the policies and practices of First Things First. What is that agreement?
It means that when the therapist went to work at First Things First, he agreed. It was a contract of hire.
The trial court made a finding, and now I'm looking at Appendix 35, contrary to that. That Appendix 35, it says, counsel for FTF argues that the plaintiff did not have an agreement with the clinic. The argument is without merit. His opinion, not mine, necessarily. Exhibit 13 is a copy of the FTF's business file regarding SJ. Each document from that file is a standard form adopted by FTF's policy manual. Many of those forms includes FTF's letterhead. So, is that the what is being referred to by the trial court as the written agreement that you're referring to also?
Yes, and I think what the trial court was trying to do, if I can be bold enough to read its mind, was to sort out some of these independent contractor employee issues. You asked earlier whether you were bound by this concept of independent contractor. When was the issue of vicarious liability raised? Well, it was not raised in the pleadings. But it was raised for the first time in trial briefs filed at the pretrial conference.
Are you asserting that it needed to be raised in the pleadings?
No. I objected to it, and the trial judge said, it did not need to be raised, and if it did, I hadn't been prejudiced by the failure to raise it earlier. And then, in essence, what we did was I was confident that the facts would support only one finding, that the relationship between the therapist and the clinic was that of an independent contractor. And indeed, although he forgot to use the magic words, he so found. That's what the Court of Appeals agreed upon as a matter of law, and that's not an issue here. That has not been raised.
Thank you.
I wanted to just briefly mention some of the things that were listed as potential catastrophic issues by the amicus brief. It talked about potential administrative chaos if the administrators had to look to determine who was admitted before they held a cause hearing on a grievances. And the answer to that is, number one, as I've said, only three potentially apply to outpatients. And number two, every administrator knows who's in his building under court compulsion and who's there as a purely voluntary outpatient.
So you have both kinds at first things first?
Yes. And I think that's true of mental health treatment facilities throughout the state. I think that's true of hospitals throughout the state. The statute recognizes that some people undergo outpatient treatment at private hospitals and general hospitals, and they are explicitly excluded. And it has never made sense to me why you would exclude an outpatient in a hospital setting, but not an outpatient in a treatment facility. The statute, 5161, goes on to say, unless there are other circumstances, and the only other circumstances I could think of would be compulsion to undergo counseling or receiving state services at a private or public general hospital in outpatient care.
If this were covered by 5161-1, then does your client have a non-delegable duty?
Yes.
Okay. Does your client have a non-delegable duty anyway?
Well, no. I spent much time over the last week looking at these non-delegable duty cases, and I was trying to find some cohesion to all of the cases. I thought I had it until I looked at Brooks, and then I was lost again until I reread Brooks, and I found what Brooks was saying, in essence, was that there are some duties that are so important that you should not allow the principal to bargain them away. And then when you look at that, all of the other cases under non-delegable duty fall into line. That includes the fellow who hires an independent contractor to get rid of bugs in his apartment building. And the fellow who hired an independent contractor to deliver fuel oil. It also includes what counsel described as the water case. And what the court said in the, I think that's the Himes Hankey case. This is where the fellow's out washing his car, and he's out washing his car in cold weather, and he's doing it on a public sidewalk, and he's bringing water and applying it on the public sidewalk. And he said, well, it was my nephew who spilled the water. And the court said, well, we're not going to allow you to say that because the nephew did it, you're not responsible because you're the one who told the nephew to do it. But more importantly, you have a duty to protect the users, the public users of that sidewalk, from harm.
And what the non-delegable duty cases have always talked about was the duty to prevent harm or damage to property where the activity itself had some high level of physical danger or a high probability of physical damage or loss of property.
Counsel, you've been talking about physical, but if you just said harm, why isn't going to a physician or going to a psychologist or psychiatrist for a treatment of mental health as important as exterminating vermin on your property?
It is, Chief Justice.
That's right. So why doesn't it come under the general rule of non-delegable? I mean, if I go to a clinic, I expect everyone in that clinic to be held to a standard of care and that the clinic is responsible for them. Otherwise, I don't go to that clinic.
And I have two replies. The first reply is that the duty, there exists right now a duty, a legal duty for the therapist not to have sexual relations with a counselee, someone who's in there for counseling. That's a violation of the criminal law. And indeed, in this case, Dr. Hatch, the therapist, was convicted and sentenced to 10 years, a year in jail and 10 years of probation.
An intentional act.
Yes. Yes.
Well, does that take it out of non-delegable duty that it's an intentional act?
Under some circumstances, no. Where the principal has actually contracted with or has some other duty to protect the third party. And the best example I can give you, of course, is what you termed a special relationship in the Janke case, Janke versus Clark County case. But there was a custodial situation there. And all of these cases where the restatement and the cases, including Indiana cases cited by counsel, deal with a duty to protect someone from harm, it is a custodial case or it is an interstate commerce case, the railroad cases, something of that sort. The trouble with finding a non-delegable duty to protect someone from a sexual relation or a physical relationship in this instance is it's such a terrible slippery slope. If you are going to make an employer or if you are going to make a principal liable for the intentional criminal acts of his independent contractor or third party, where do you stop? I have no trouble saying if I contract to ship gold for a third party from Rice Lake to Madison, and I hire an independent contractor to do it, that I am liable if this independent contractor intentionally thwarts that contract by stealing the gold. But if he stops in Eau Claire and robs a bank or commits some other felony on the way, I'm not responsible.
And what's this analogous to? Is stealing the gold or robbing a third bank? What's this case analogous to?
It's analogous to robbing the bank.
Well, I would say perhaps that it's analogous to stealing the gold. And if you do this, more and more entities are contracting out so that there's independent contractors. So if you had a hospital that did an independent contract with a nursing service, and the nursing service supplied all the nurses, and then the nurse is, and let's just go for negligence first. The nurse is negligent. You would say that nurse is, that the hospital is not liable for the nurse?
The short answer, because my red light is on, Chief Justice, is that it is equally applicable whether it's an employee or an independent contractor.
I gave you negligence.
So you're saying that the hospital is liable for the nurse?
If it is a committed patient, as it was in the Wright case.
Just take it out of this situation. We've stopped on that. I'm asking you if there's a non-delegable duty, even if it's not a patient under 51.61, a non-delegable duty of care.
If there is a non-delegable duty that you find to make the employer or the principal an insurer of the health of anyone who walks in through the portals.
Your response is, if it's an independent contract, if I understand it, there is no non-delegable duty. That is, the duty is that of the independent contractor, not the first case. First care first. Well, first things first, sorry. So you just don't think there's a non-delegable duty here?
I do not, Chief Justice.
Thank you. Justice Craig.
Thank you.
I know your red light's on, but Chief, if I may.
Yes, go ahead.
I want to go back to that area of inquiry concerning the pages in the appendix, pages 35 and continuing on, 45 and a few pages after that, where the trial court made a finding based on Exhibit 13 that there was and then also makes reference to another exhibit, that there was a contract. That is, there were insurance forms and forms for payment signed, and that there was also, and the trial court quotes, you know, that there is attached to that a statement that says, in essence, that there are Bill of Rights accorded to SJ, and those include the Bill of Rights under Chapter 5161, and the trial court quoted in the transcript the rights to be free of sexual harassment by staff. Again, I'm referring to page 45 of the transcript. I just don't understand how you get around that. Tell me. Now, I thought maybe you would say, well, they didn't plead it in the complaint, but then you said, no, you're not raising that because it was raised right away in the trial procedure and the court's findings. So how do you get around the trial court statement on those pages that says there is a contract and that FTF specifically said you have the rights in 5161 and specifically said, quoting page 45, it is the policy of First Things First to allow no sexual exploitation or harassment, etc., no sexual contact or harassment is permitted. How do you get around that? I didn't understand.
Because the Block and the LLN Clotter cases have said that sexual relationships outside of the scope of employment, when it is not a part of therapy and when the therapist knows that it is prohibited, make...
I remember LLM quite well.
I'm sure you do. It was.
I reread that case periodically. At any rate,
would make what? What? Okay, he was saying... Those cases make what? Sex outside the scope of authority are, under those cases, what?
What those Court of Appeals cases said in each instance was that where sexual relations with a therapist, by a therapist with a patient, are outside the scope of employment, then there is no vicarious liability. But you have to, there was a caveat attached to both of those decisions, those Court of Appeals decisions, and the caveat was that the employer had to have a policy and that the employee, in either case, because as I recall, in both LLN and in Block, we were dealing with an employee, but in either case, the Court of Appeals said that he, or I think he in each instance, had to know it was against the policy of the employer. That was part of the...
Right. And here the independent contractor knows, right? Here the independent contractor knows.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. But
Mr. Pellis, I have one other question. You referred to the Janke versus Clark County case. I'm a little bit confused about where contributory negligence stands at this point in the case, particularly if the court were to find a non-delegable duty of some sort.
This case, contributory negligence, is not an issue before you. The trial, the jury actually found the therapist 80%, the clinic 10% contributory negligent for failing to properly supervise, and it found SJAJ 10% contributory negligent for her own safety. The trial judge ruled that she could not be negligent as a matter of law because 895.70, the six-month prohibition in 895.70 was not met. That was the same interpretation. I appealed that issue to the Court of Appeals, and that was the same decision that the Court of Appeals made in the underlying decision. I have not raised that issue on cross-petition. Have I answered your question? Thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you, Mr. Pellis. Mr. Steens, you have 5 minutes.
Just a few very quick points in rebuttal. First of all, Chief Justice, I believe that the date that's active for the changes that I was mentioning in my original argument is 1993 Act 445, and it's on page 9 of the coalition's brief. The two exhibits that you have been questioning about, one is Plaintiff's Exhibit 61, which is at page 110 of our brief to the Court of Appeals, and that's the contract between Hatch and First Things First, and it provides at paragraph 3 that Dr. Hatch agrees to abide by all of the policies and practices of First Things First as outlined in the administrative code, including ethical practice, confidentiality, timely record keeping, etc., and further, that failure to do so is cause for immediate suspension or revocation of the agreement. The other is Exhibit 13, which is the file that was referred to that has the insurance forms in it, signed by SJAJ, which says, I hereby authorize payment directly to First Things First for any charges incurred at this clinic, and I understand that I'm personally responsible for paying for that. And also within that file, on the forms with the First Things First heading on it, is the First Things First client Bill of Rights. That page is not signed, but it's a part of it by record, is a part of the the patient's file at the First Things First, not Dr. Hatch's file, First Things First file.
What is the evidence surrounding that document?
Pardon?
What is the related evidence surrounding that document? Do we know if it was provided to the plaintiff?
Oh, yes. She signed insurance form.
No, the other document, the one that references First Things First clients, patients, Bill of Rights. You said that's in the file, it's unsigned.
My belief, my memory of the record is that that she remembered receiving that, and that the principals of the clinic, as well as their office staff, said that it was normal practice and procedure to present this to every patient at the time they started to receive services at the clinic. Now, that's my best memory. Also in argument, Mr. Pellis, the question was asked, why would a hospital emergency room be removed from responsibility under 5161, whereas in an outpatient circumstance at a hospital, why is that different from an outpatient mental health clinic? Well, the big difference is, of course, that you don't have to have a psychologist or a psychiatrist on staff to have an emergency room. But you do have to have a psychologist or a psychiatrist on staff to be licensed by the state as a mental health facility. As I remember law school, when we talk about duty, we often talk about foreseeability. And the other issue here is whether it's foreseeable to a mental health clinic that its patients may be subject to sexual exploitation by therapists. And if you look at the materials in our brief that address that, it's very clear within the literature. The principals of the First Things First said that they were aware of that risk. In fact, they knew that this particular doctor had previously lost his license because of improper contact with a female patient. It's clear, it seems to me, that the legislature, among other things, has said we do not want people who are receiving mental health services to be subject to sexual exploitation. That being so, when you read 5161 and look at the contract and everything else, I can't see how there can be anything except a non-delegable duty on that particular issue.
The fact that he had his own malpractice insurance was not a forerunner. In other words, on this, that there was not an anticipation that he was acting in his own capacity, the doctor, Dr. Hatch.
I guess I don't know that I can answer that because I don't know what was in the minds of the principals of First Things First when they added that provision. I do know that the record is clear that they were dealing with Dr. Hatch at the time of this improper conduct, wanting him to become one of the principals of the organization, and he just didn't happen to go along at that time. I have a red light.
Justice Bradley has a question.
Thank you, Chief. On page 57 of the appendix, on the index to the record, number 77, it says, exhibit list, actual exhibits available upon request. Do you have any problem if any of those exhibits are requested?
No.
Chief, may I ask?
Hey, Mr. Pella should respond to that, too. Is that what you're going to say, Justice? Do you have any objection if the court gets additional exhibits? Do you want to be notified? Do each of you wish to be notified if the court requests those exhibits?
Well, I think it'd be nice.
I do too, counsel. We'll notify you. All right. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Steens, and thank you, Mr. Pellish, for appearing today and giving the benefit.